You're with us on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and we're talking about research advancements in the area of psychedelic medicine to help with a range of mental health illnesses, including depression, anorexia, and addiction. Psychedelic drugs, LSD, psilocybin, mescaline, they have been illegal in our country for decades. Some substances are Schedule I drugs, and that means they have a high potential for abuse and no currently accepted medical treatment here in the U.S. But now there's new research dollars and an increasing acceptance of psychedelic studies. So what do you want to know about psychedelic drugs and how these substances affect the brain? Have you or someone you know tried one of these drugs in a clinical setting? Join in 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Alan K. Davis is an assistant professor of social work at The Ohio State University and an adjunct assistant professor at the New Center for Psychedelic and Consciousness Research at Johns Hopkins University. Alan, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
All right. So we're going to have some terminology here this morning, including these psychedelic drugs. First of all, psilocybin and LSD. What are they? How do they affect the brain?
So these substances are in a broad class of what we call classic psychedelics or classic hallucinogens. These substances typically have primary effect on the serotonin system in the brain. And so that's the system that is largely responsible for things like regulating your mood and sleep and appetite. And so these substances also can produce pretty strong visual and emotional and physical experiences. In general, those kind of vary by time depending on the substance, but that's kind of a basic overview.
And, you know, some of these, like LSD, and you think of maybe the 1960s, how long have researchers thought these drugs could have therapeutic benefits? Where did they come from?
Well, you know, some of these substances have had, thousands of years of use in terms of indigenous use in ceremonial contexts. There were a lot of tribes in different parts of the world that would use these for healing and for personal growth. In the early 50s and 60s, these substances were also being widely researched, and there were a lot of studies published, over 1,000 studies published, showing that they had potential therapeutic benefit. And it wasn't until the Controlled Substance Act, where pretty much every substance was kind of labeled as problematic and banned for use. So when that happened, unfortunately, research ended for the most part. And it took about 2 to 3 decades for the regulatory hurdles to be overcome in order to start studying them again.
And then last fall, the Food and Drug Administration gave psilocybin therapy status for treatment-resistant depression. But then the DEA, the Drug Enforcement Administration, still classifies it as a Schedule I drug. So how has research looking at these psychedelic drugs been stalled by federal regulations?
You know, it's been a real challenge. It's a huge hurdle to get through these different processes. For example, our recent study of depression that we're just finishing up at Hopkins, it took approximately 2 years before we could even start enrolling potential volunteers just to get through the FDA, the DEA, and of course the institutional IRBs. So it's a huge hurdle. It costs a lot of time and money, and it's a real challenge. You know, the reason that it hasn't been reclassified yet is because, you know, FDA has still yet to have enough evidence to consider approving it for wide use in clinical settings. And until that happens, the DEA is unlikely to make any changes to their scheduling process.
We're talking about advancements in psychedelic medicine. What's on the horizon for upcoming studies with Alan K. Davis? He's a researcher at the Center for Psychedelic and Consciousness Research at Johns Hopkins University. You can join in. Have you had a negative or positive experience with psychedelic drugs? Have these drugs had a therapeutic effect for you or the opposite? Join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. So, so far, Alan, what have researchers learned about the therapeutic uses of psychedelic drugs? What are some of the more aha moments here?
Well, you know, one of the really, you know, amazing recent findings that I'm actually going to be presenting today at the University of Michigan is that our depression trial found that after only two doses, so two sessions of psilocybin alongside about 13 sessions of psychotherapy, we found that people with chronic long-term depression, about 60% of them completely remitted from their depression after that intervention. And that's huge. That's about double the amount of people that have a remission from depression as related to antidepressants or psychotherapy alone.
So with that, armed with that knowledge, where do you take the trials at this point when you have results that look so promising?
So actually, that stuff is already in process, which is great. And it's actually being led by a company in Madison, Wisconsin. USONA Institute has launched and is backing a multi-site phase 2 and 3 trial for depression. And that multi-site trial will enroll many more participants across many sites around the country. And that's the type of data that the FDA will then use to decide whether or not it should be made available to the public.
So surveys have found therapeutic effects for some recreational users of these drugs. What do you make of that finding, also given that you have these clinical findings?
You know, I think that there are still some risks involved with, you know, people deciding to do this on their own, and I would caution listeners to be safe with their choices. However, these substances, like I mentioned earlier, have been used for thousands of years, certainly in the case of things like psilocybin mushrooms, and so there's a long history of safe administration and safe experiences. However, one thing that we know from the trials is that having a safe setting, so having a safe environment with supportive people who know how to help in case something challenging comes up, is a real critical component about why we think these are effective. Now, there are some people who do have recreational experiences, or they'll go to some other type of, you know, non-research setting to have these experiences, and they do report that these substances can bring about spontaneous changes in their mood for the better. Some people don't even expect that to happen, but it happens and they kind of realize that the benefits are there.
Well, walk us through what that might be like for safe administration in a safe setting for something like psilocybin.
Well, you know, some of the things that we've seen in our survey-based research, when we ask people about what kinds of practices they use to keep themselves safe when they use these substances, they actually look very similar to the kinds of practices that we might employ in a research setting. So, for example, having someone that you trust there who is not using psilocybin, but who can kind of be a sitter or someone to go to for support if you need it, seems to be an important factor. Also, having, you know, a thoughtful intention or moment to reflect on the reasons why you're seeking out this experience seems to be helpful to help kind of guide the internal experience that one might have. But also things like making sure you're in a safe setting, making sure that you have the things you need, like, for example, music ready and other things to kind of make sure that your whole experience is a supported one.
How long might that experience take when you give a dose?
Well, for psilocybin, it's the acute effects of the substance are anywhere from 4 to 6 hours, depending on the person's body weight and their metabolism, and of course the dose of the substance. For something like LSD, that quickly doubles or triples. That can be up to 10 to 12 hours. So it really varies a lot by which substance you're talking about.
We're talking about research advancements in the area of psychedelics. Ellen K. Davis is an adjunct assistant professor at the Center for Psychedelic and Consciousness Research at Johns Hopkins University. What are your questions about, you know, how hallucinogenic drugs work, like LSD, and how they can impact mental health conditions and how these substances actually affect the brain? Join in 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Back in a minute here on the Ideas Network. We'll be right back. You're with us on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and we're talking about psychedelic medicine. Some studies suggest compounds in mushrooms could be beneficial for treating anxiety, depression, other mental health issues. And this is a real jumping off point for a center on psychedelic medicine that just opened at Johns Hopkins in Baltimore. And their upcoming studies will determine the effectiveness of psilocybin as a new therapy for treating opioid addiction, for treating Alzheimer's, PTSD, anorexia, other areas of mental health. Do you have a chronic depression or other mental illness? Would you consider trying a non-conventional therapy? Join in 800-642-1234. Alan K. Davis is our guide. He's an adjunct assistant professor at the Center for Psychedelic and Consciousness Research at Johns Hopkins. Let's go to the phones now. Jonathan is joining us from Walworth. Hi, Jonathan.
How's it going this morning?
Good. Go ahead.
So I just wanted to kind of reinforce what your guest said about these medicines being used for thousands of years and how it's kind of unfortunate that Western society has demonized them. But for me personally, I've been battling with, a lot of trauma from my childhood, from heavy neglect, battling with obesity and other things like that. And, psychedelics and most prominently psilocybin had a huge impact on helping me to overcome some of that and to overcome obesity and to become a stronger person. And now with just some traditional talk therapy and occasional, maybe yearly use of psilocybin, I'm able to maintain a very high state of function and not really fall into depression. And it's an amazing medicine. And I fully hope that people can get on board with this and help doctors do the work that they need to do to help people.
Jonathan, thank you for telling your story. Alan, it sounds like Jonathan has a history of here that is really working.
Absolutely. And that's one of the things that keeps us inspired to continue, the work that we're doing to overcome the regulatory hurdles with the different federal agencies, because we know that people are experiencing these kinds of benefits. We're seeing that in our trials, and we're hearing from people like Jonathan. And yeah, it's pretty remarkable to hear the kind of effects he's had.
Let's go to Sam now in Oconomowoc. Hi, Sam.
Hello. Thank you for taking the call. Yes. I had a 30-year-plus habit of addiction, call it what it is, to cocaine. I could not get away from it. I had gotten to the point where I decided that at any means I was going to find a way away. And it wasn't looking good, the solutions that was coming up in my head. Somebody pointed out that psilocybin had been used for trying to treat heroin addiction. So I tried. I am now cocaine-free for over 3 years. I also, in the time since then, have helped three other heroin addicts wean themselves off and get away from heroin. And using the psilocybin as a kind of crutch, I guess, in term, and they're away from their heroin habits, and we don't recreationally use the psilocybin, but as a tool, it was a lifesaver.
Well, Sam, thanks for calling in. Alan, what is the impact? What do we know here about psychedelic drugs, perhaps helping people kick an addiction like cocaine?
Well, one thing that we think is going on is actually what we kind of label a transdiagnostic process of change, which basically means that we think psilocybin has an ability to induce in people experiences that are intensely positive and transcendent and spiritual or mystical in nature. And at the same time, they also have the capacity to bring about very strong psychological insights. And this quantum level of change that we call it seems to help people with a variety of problems, including addiction, as well as people who have trauma or depression or anxiety or existential distress. So that's one of the reasons why we're going in the direction of these other populations, people with PTSD and opiate use problems, debilitating conditions that also have at their core some of these same basic processes that could be helpful for them.
Upcoming studies that you have also include patients who have Alzheimer's and PTSD. What about these specific populations of people battling diseases like Alzheimer's?
Well, you know, one of the landmark studies that we published a few years ago was done in cancer patients, and the psilocybin was not used as a treatment for cancer, obviously, but it was used to help people who, because of their cancer diagnosis, they became depressed or anxious. And that psychological distress is very debilitating. And what we know in the literature is that that psychological distress that happens when people have a terminal illness actually reduces their quality of life and makes it much more difficult for them to connect with their families and engage with the time they have left. And so the same is true with Alzheimer's. And so we're hoping that, you know, by working with Alzheimer's patients and their families, that we might help people, you know, to decrease that psychological distress and help them engage in a higher quality of life.
We're talking about psychedelic medicine. What's on the horizon for hallucinogenic drugs like LSD? Alan K. Davis is our guide. He's a researcher at Johns Hopkins University at the Center for Psychedelic and Consciousness Research. You can join in 800-642-1234. Let's go to Brian now in Milwaukee. Hi, Brian.
Hi, good morning, and thanks for taking my phone call. I think you touched a little bit on my question, answering my question, which was kind of two parts. So, number one, how the subjects with depression, what do they report, how the drug works, why it works for them? And then the second part of my question is just, how do you go about standardizing the clinical setting for when you're going through the drug trials? How do you go about standardizing the setting and the experience for these participants?
Brian, thanks. Ellen, go ahead.
Yeah, so in terms of the recent question about the setting, one thing that we do is that the setting is not your typical hospital setting or research setting. In fact, the environment where the sessions take place, it looks much more like your living room in your own home. We have a couch and tables and floor rugs and nice lighting with table lamps and chairs and bookshelf. And what we've done is we've done what we can to create as peaceful and calming environment as possible. And we also invite the volunteer who's there for the study to also make the room their own and bring in pictures and any other things that they want from their own home environment to create a comfortable space for themselves. And we think that that's part also answers the first part of the gentleman's question about what we think is helpful. You know, having that calming environment seems to create a sense of safety so that people are able to trust and let go and be open into whatever experience comes up as part of their psilocybin journey. And those experiences that people then come back and report on as being helpful to them, you know, as I mentioned earlier, often include things of a spiritual or transcendent nature. People usually come through this experience feeling connected in a more deep way to themselves and to their families and to community, and for some of them also to God or a spiritual connection, and the insights that they get as part of that, the ways in which they take that information and actually apply it to their day-to-day life seems to be what creates and supports a lasting change.
Brian, thanks. Justin in Kenosha is with us. Justin, hi.
Oh, hello. Good morning. Thanks for taking my phone call. I'm really glad to hear about this, these advances. I'm a social worker, and I have a lot of patients and clients who have severe alcohol use disorders, and I kind of had two questions. One, I'm wondering how long it'll be until this could be like a mainline treatment, because the mainline treatments are really not very effective.
Oh, I'm sorry, Justin. It sounds like you just dropped. Basically looking, what is the timeline until, you know, social workers and other medical professionals might be able to use this in their clinical practice?
You know, we're still some years away from that. It'll be at least a couple of years before FDA will have the type of evidence that it needs to make a ruling on whether it should be made available as a treatment. And once it's made available as a treatment, you know, that will put the DEA in a space where they'll need to decide whether or not to reschedule the psilocybin. And if and when that happens, I think that we will see the ability to not only do a lot more research, which can then, you know, give kind of evidence that we need to make it a frontline treatment for different conditions, like people with alcohol use problems. But this is still kind of in its early stages before this will be made available widely to the public.
Justin, are you still there?
Oh, yeah, still here.
Yeah, did that answer your question?
Yeah, I had one other question. I was wondering how I could get involved and how I can be more helpful with this.
Well, you know, one of the things that is going to be crucial for this work going forward is for people to, in the community, both, you know, people like Justin, who's a social worker and a provider of clinical services, as well as families and other people, to start to have a dialogue about, you know, what would it look like if you had a family member or a client who's had these experiences? How can you support them in their process of change? And one of the things that I think we'll need to do as a culture and in various communities is to create places where conversations can take place about these types of experiences. So having dialogue, talking to community members and family members about, you know, what you're learning or what you're seeing and what you're reading, those conversations will go a long way to support the work when it eventually is widely disseminated.
Alan, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Alan K. Davis is an assistant professor of social work at The Ohio State University and an adjunct assistant professor at the Center for Psychedelic and Consciousness Research at Johns Hopkins University. Coming up, New State data is out on standardized testing results this morning from the Department of Public Instruction, and the results show a narrowing of the achievement gap, but only because white students' performances declined, not because scores by African American students increased. We'll break down the New State data right after this news update. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the morning show as we check in on how rural Wisconsin is doing amid the pandemic. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The early months of the COVID outbreak, we were trained on watching developments emerge from our country's big cities like New York and New Orleans, Chicago, Seattle. But researchers say that rural America is especially vulnerable to the virus and its effects because of an aging population and because of less access to healthcare. Are you a healthcare provider in a rural area? What have you experienced in recent months? What supplies and assistance are you lacking? What creative partnerships or workarounds have you created due to the pandemic? We're at 800-642-1234. John Ike is director of the Wisconsin Office of Rural Health, which works to improve access to and the quality of rural health care. John, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Well, it's been some months when we last spoke. How are rural areas doing right now amid the pandemic and their health care systems?
Well, I would say that they're doing similarly in that the greatest hit from COVID is going to be financial. There are cases, there are places where there have been spreader events, but they are fewer and farther in between. So when you look at a map of cases or incidents in Wisconsin, those clusters are going to be around like Southeast Wisconsin, Brown County, and Fox Valley, et cetera. So from the standpoint of cases, I would say one of the biggest impacts is going to be people postponing care. People are nervous to go in. At first, non-elective was not supposed to go in. And then after that was opened up, people still feel nervous about going into where they might catch COVID-19. And so people are postponing their care. They're calling later than they normally would. So when the EMS shows up at the door where they might have somebody with chest pain, they're more likely to be staying in full cardiac arrest. That means that the patient outcomes are not as good as they could be. The sooner people can get into care, the better their chances long term.
Well, and so, when you postpone care as well and the non-elective procedures, that can have implications on rural clinics that need a flow of those procedures in order to make their budgets work.
Yeah, it's absolutely true. When I talk to rural hospitals and rural EMS services, they've been dramatically hit financially by this. And the federal support has been helpful, but we're talking losses of 50%+ of revenue, and it's hard to overcome that. So we're seeing some closures in EMS services. We're seeing some sort of, I mean, on the good side, maybe more collaboration and even mergers. But at the same time, people are struggling financially, and the communities themselves are not necessarily in a good position. Volunteer services and EMS have long relied on sort of the pancake breakfast or other ways to creatively make revenue. And the residents themselves have less money. People don't want to gather socially. So as I said, it's the financial hit has been one of the hardest.
Can you quantify closures with EMS services? What have you seen?
I don't have numbers on all of them. I've just heard of several cases.
Uh-huh.
EMS in rural has longstanding issues. They tend to be more volunteer based. They tend to be cash strapped. A few party volunteers carrying the lion's share. So they were stretched thin before this happened. And then when their runs went down, their revenue goes down, that was very painful.
Well, that echoes what the head of the National Rural Health Association said throughout this statistic, that as of February 1st, nearly half of rural hospitals were operating at a loss. And this was prior to the COVID outbreak in our country. So if they were in these financial situations heading into the pandemic, I can't imagine what it looks like right now for these hospitals.
Yes, and I will say that that quote and those numbers are reflective of the entire country, mm-hmm. and all the different regions. And in Wisconsin, we're lucky enough to have hospitals in particular that are doing better than the national average, that are stronger. It's not to say they still don't look at their numbers closely at the end of every month, but we haven't had a closure in a long time. And I wouldn't say that we had any that are right around the corner from a closure. But this kind of impact, like I said, the loss of this kind of revenue is hard for anyone. You can imagine if your own income were slashed by 50%, how difficult that would be. And that's the position that rural hospitals, EMS, and clinics are all in.
The CARES Act, the first stimulus, had included a $100 billion fund to help hospitals and other healthcare providers. Did those dollars, are they getting to rural health clinics and hospitals?
They are. I would say the biggest struggle of getting that money out has actually been EMS again. I think the hospitals received the money. They were luckily the federal government had a couple of different sources. Our office helped to send out a certain payment, but at the same time, again, it's sort of a drop in the bucket. I mean, it's wonderful that the federal government stepped up the way they did for this, but at the same time, the costs are just too large. It helps, but it's not enough to make things whole again.
What are you looking for out of the second stimulus that's in the works?
Basically, more of the same. I mean, in the previous amounts, they were luckily pretty flexible. The federal government at times can be fairly restrictive about the way it sends payments, the way it directs it. And last time, they were pretty flexible. They said, use this for staffing, use it for services, use it for what you need. And so we're hoping to see that again.
Talking with John Ike, director of the Wisconsin Office of Rural Health, which works to improve access to and the quality of rural health care. Getting at your questions, are you a health care provider in a rural area? What have you experienced in recent months? Tell us what supplies you need. How close do you live to a hospital? Are you concerned about getting access to health care where you live, especially amid the pandemic? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. So, John, let's circle back to the healthcare amid COVID. If an outbreak were to happen in a rural community, how prepared are rural facilities for these hospitalizations? How many beds are we looking at? How are they constructing these facilities to, put COVID patients in one particular area?
Actually, I think they're doing pretty well. The movement in healthcare over the last 20 years has actually been, we started out with much larger hospitals, and as medicine progressed, people were getting shorter and shorter stays inpatient, and they were doing a lot of their care outpatient, or in other words, they would come for the day and then leave. So our hospitals are built large enough to have more space than we actually were using before COVID. So we literally have sort of footprint that's large enough. Whether or not we have staffing is another issue. You know, when the revenue went down, people had to make the hard decisions about furloughing or laying off staff, which is odd because, in a sense, you know, one of our biggest concerns has always been workforce. But if you just don't have the payroll, you have to make those kind of decisions. So the fear there really is workforce versus beds. We're doing okay with personal protective equipment, masks and other things. There's not enough yet. You know, the supply chain hasn't fully recovered to the point where if hospitals want to become testing centers. But at the same time, we're in a much better place with that. The biggest concern is if there is an event in a community, are they going to be able to have the staffing? And also, we have a good system of spreading people around. If there's a patient that comes into a hospital, a rural hospital, and if for some reason there isn't enough room, there are nearby hospitals as well. So we can do that. One of the things I think is interesting about this, when I talk to people, is that in the beginning, there was a lot of fear and uncertainty about catching it. I think that's why the shutdowns happened, et cetera. We didn't know what we were dealing with. Now we have a much better sense of it. So there is less uncertainty and less fear, and more people just kind of putting their heads down and doing the work.
When you looked at the furloughs that took place, were they concentrated in specific specialties? Did they happen in certain areas? Did they happen to entire clinics? What patterns did you see out of furloughing?
Well, I think I draw an analogy to sort of personal finance. So if you look at if somebody was really solid finances before COVID happened, they have more resources to weather it. If they were more on the line, if they were more, you know, if at the end of every month it was just scraping by, then this kind of hit is going to be a much more dramatic one. So I wouldn't say it was necessarily geographic. It sort of depends facility to facility, service to service, whether or not, you know, how strong they were doing before that, and whether or not they needed to take more drastic action like layoffs or furloughs.
And I would assume it was those elective procedure areas and the specialties that work in elective procedures that perhaps had those difficulties with furloughs.
Yeah, well, I mean, in rural, you're primarily looking at primary care. In other words, when you go to your sort of general practitioner, that's what you have more of those specialties. In rural areas, there's not the patient volume for sort of like intense cardiac work, pediatric oncology, those sort of specialties and subspecialties. Those tend to be in the urban areas. So for the most part, most of the practice is primary care. And so it wasn't necessarily that rural would take the hit as far as specialty layoffs. That would happen more in urban areas.
We have John Ike with us, who heads up the Wisconsin Office of Rural Health. Are you a physician or clinician practicing in a rural community? Are your patients worried about the pandemic? Do you have a plan for how to respond if cases are diagnosed in your community or there is significant spread? Do you work at a rural hospital? Do you have COVID beds filled now? How have you prepared for cases? Still time to talk, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're checking in on rural health care amid the pandemic. According to the liberal think tank, the Center for American Progress, a report published this week indicates the pandemic has quickly spread to rural communities that are not well positioned to address a global health crisis. Your insights, your perspectives from a rural area, they're welcome at 800-642-1234. John Ike is director of the Wisconsin Office of Rural Health, and he stays with us. John, you know, as we were in the throes of the pandemic, there was a renewed push for telehealth. What is the capacity for rural providers to offer these digital telehealth services?
The growth in telehealth use and the regulation changes have been really welcome. Basically, I think what was getting in the way of telehealth before was not so much the technology. Rural facilities, you know, had the fiber for the signal, and they had the equipment itself. But what they didn't have was the ability to sort of make the connections between, say, an urban provider and a rural patient in the sense of referral networks, in the sense of payments. The payment model is kind of strange. It's where historically it's been where the provider themselves is, they get the lion's share of the payment, and where the patient is and the rural clinic, say, where they're at, gets a paltry amount. So the math doesn't really work out there. So that was changed with regulation, only temporarily. So we're hoping that that is sort of made permanent. I think really kind of an interesting area for this is providers reaching out into the community itself. So can patients access this kind of care? Can you get care from your home or from your phone? And that's is a real concern in rural, just because we have both a lack of cell signal reaching everywhere as it should, and broadband. Broadband is an issue not just for health, but for rural economic development as well. And when we look at jobs, they go to increasingly in rural areas, they're going to sort of single proprietorships or very small companies, say under 5 employees, and they depend on the internet for business. Mm. And if they don't have broadband, then they can't keep up economically.
Yeah, we talked yesterday with Brittany Beyer, the executive director of Grow North Economic Development Corporation, about she's chairing Governor Evers' new task force examining high-speed internet needs.
I think COVID-19 and the closures really brought this back to the forefront. Since taking over this position, it was extremely clear that for our rural communities, internet is absolutely an imperative thing to fix as soon as we can.
What kinds of infrastructure changes are needed as you look at healthcare in rural areas?
Well, as far as healthcare goes itself, I think infrastructure is doing quite well. If we look at internet access, mm-hmm. though, I mean, you know, years ago, hospitals made the investments to sort of dig fiber all the way to their hospital and have redundant backup because they've needed this for, again, 20 years. But for the rest of the community, that is not the case. And I think one of the greatest dangers, if I could, is that the government tends to sort of turn this over to the telecommunications companies, sort of the AT&Ts, et cetera, and say, hey, why don't you guys just handle that? Well, it's not in their best interest to handle it because you have a low volume of residents compared to the cost of sort of digging fiber everywhere. So that hasn't worked. So we have to figure out other ways of doing this.
We're talking with John Eich, director of the Wisconsin Office of Rural Health. We're getting a glimpse of how rural health providers are doing amid the pandemic with your insights at 800-642-1234. John, you mentioned there that providers are reaching out into the community. Can you help us understand, like, what policies have made telehealth and other offerings in rural settings easier for providers and their patients?
So again, there's this sense of, because, you know, healthcare is, while a public good, is also people have to be paid for the work that they do. And for whatever reason, and I'm not even sure why, the way this telehealth reimbursements have been set up are really putting rural at a disadvantage. They're saying a rural site cannot provide the care. You know, they can only receive the care, which doesn't suit. I mean, if you look at a system, say like Marshfield, that has incredible specialists at the sort of at the mothership, nonetheless, that would be qualified or sort of classified as a rural area. Those providers could provide services all over the state to other rural areas, but again, the reimbursement is so skewed against them that it doesn't make it worthwhile. So that's been changed temporarily. And again, we'd like to see that continue moving forward.
I was looking at the Iowa Hospital Association across the border, projecting state hospitals there will lose about $1.4 billion by September as a result of the COVID shutdown. How are state hospitals doing?
They are struggling with that kind of impact. I mean, I don't think that's atypical for us. At the same time, like I said, we have been in a pretty good position. It's not to say, I mean, both things are true. That is a dramatic impact. And I don't necessarily get the sense that any rural hospitals are at risk of closing tomorrow. I think we have to acknowledge the fact that this is a very serious impact to our healthcare delivery system and be glad that we're weathering it as well as we are.
Where do you see mergers taking place, and are there any talks right now?
We are in a cycle of mergers before this. I mean, if you look at some of the largest healthcare systems, if you looked at 30 years ago, the level of independent hospitals and clinics compared to today, it's been a big shift. Even the systems that we once considered large, like the Auroras, are now part of Aurora Advocate, et cetera. That is happening more and more, where our regional systems are talking with each other, but national systems are coming in with a lot of resources looking to scoop up options. So this is the way healthcare is going before COVID, and I think COVID's impacts are only going to accelerate that.
Are there changes you're seeing amid the pandemic in the rural system that, once a vaccine comes along, once this pandemic is over, that you hope can be sustained?
That's an interesting question. You know, I think that in any time of crisis, people come together more. And I think we certainly saw that in the beginning of this. But I think we're seeing it overall. And that has been refreshing. It's been nice to see systems reaching out to other systems, hospitals and EMS reaching out to each other more than usual, EMS services reaching out to their neighbors for assistance. So continuing that level of collaboration, I mean, I think Wisconsin is lucky in that we've always done pretty well with that, but seeing it happen even more is something. I think the focus on people has been incredible. People reaching out for neighbors. I mean, that's always the strength of rural, is people know their neighbors better. But again, hearing the stories of people in need and people stepping forward for that, while that's not necessarily healthcare specific, it is an overall social movement that I think we've seen in healthcare as well.
So these silos are coming down within healthcare. At the end of the day, will that benefit these rural communities that are in itself aging?
Yes, I think one of the largest issues we have to look at in rural is, do we have senior-friendly communities? In other words, we have a lot of seniors there, but are the communities prepared to make their needs, to meet their needs in a way that feels good? We can't just have everyone go to a long-term care facility. A lot of rural people want to stay in their homes, so what options do we have for them? For shopping and for socializing, et cetera. So yeah, that is definitely a concern. It was before, and it is more so now with the lack of ability to be as social as we used to be.
John, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you for asking about this.
John Ike is director of the Wisconsin Office of Rural Health. Just ahead, it's On Point. President Trump said he may not accept the November election results. What would happen next? That is On Point. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It is The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.